Good morning, McDowell man. This is working. All right. This is... this is a fairly simple idea that, you know, if you... okay. If you put... where's my fingers? If you feed salt water, you know, like seawater, into a big area that's enclosed and sort of, say, double glazed and all this sort of stuff, if it's a thin sheet of salt water, it'll heat on a dark surface underneath it. That salt water will heat up very, very quickly with, say, sunlight, say, from... oh, say 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. You got a window. And we won't sort of get too nitpicky about it, but if you know, there's what is called a solar constant, which means that they sort of said, well, rather than, you know, how much sunlight gets on the when you can see how much sunlight, you know, when you're standing on the North Pole, which is actually the South Pole, which is on the top of the world, right? If you can see the sun like a square, like there's the roundness of it all, you know, and you can see the sun, well, how much sun or light would be falling sort of on the ground, you know, versus how much sun would be falling on the, like at midday type thing, versus how much sun would be falling on the ground at sort of the equator, you know. And they said, yeah, and how much sun is landing on the ground between sunrise and sunset. And all these sort of clever people, they just said, look, we're not going to nitpick about every fucking location and seasonal thing and early in the day and late in the day and midnight and all this sort of stuff. So in order to evaluate many solar dependent things like solar cells and solar processes, we're just going to call it the solar constant and average it out to say it's 1,000 watts a square meter, just for all the sort of science. So we've got a benchmark to evaluate things, and I came up with a very simple way. Was it like a very shallow sort of pond, you know, filled with salt water coming in, very shallow pond of seawater that's enclosed in a double glazed glass house, right? So, and we'll say you're getting 1,000 watts a square meter. And because it's enclosed, the fucking temperature's just going to go boof, straight up, you know. And so that's cold seawater coming in at, say, 15 degrees Celsius, you know. Now, I saw all those... I've got to kick back a bit. I saw all these super huge desalination plants, you know, osmotic, fucking this, that and the other, and I thought these are so big and complex and there's so much involved with them and such high costs and such high maintenance and all this other sort of shit. I thought, you fucking cunts are so stupid. This is a scam, you know. Because what happens is if you've got, say, 50 metres wide and 200 metres long, and you've got like that much seawater coming into it, you know, at a depth, you know, like a flat pool, you know. Well, basically, once that water is hot, it's turning to steam. The salt water concentrates into a very, very strong... There's a point where brine starts... The salt starts to crystallise out. So you have your brine solution, say, 20% below that, 10% below that. You know what I mean? Your concentration level. So you're getting very, very salty water, which is ready for immediate sort of further evaporation in a proper salt reclamation, salt extraction plant. You know what I mean? Just evaporation, you know, salt ponds. And, but because there's all this energy coming down into this area, the salt water, the very, very hot salt water, can be used to preheat the incoming cold salt water, right? And all the distilled water can, the hot water can also, the hot steam condensing as hot water, that can also be used to preheat through corrosion resistant heat exchangers. And so essentially, if you had, say, we'll just say for simple mathematics, right, if we had, say, 100 meters by, or say 50 meters wide by, say, 200 meters long, that would be 1,000, or that would be 100 by 100 meters, you know. And at 1,000 watts a square meter from the sunlight, say from 9 a.m. to 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., you know, that's an awful lot of energy. Or it's 100 times 100 meters long, 100 meters wide, you know what I mean? That's what 200 meters by 50 comes to. That's an awful lot of energy. That's 1,000 watts times 100 by 100. I'll pause this while I do the fucking calculations. It's easy, but there's so many. I'll make myself fucking do it, you know. That's... So we got 1,000, 1 and 3 zeros, and 100 times 100 is 10,000. Yeah, 10,000 square meter. 10,000 times 1,000 is 100,000 watts of heat energy, you know. And if you've got heat retention, you know, good insulation and all this sort of stuff, and you can reclaim probably 85% of that heat energy. I don't know, I forget the evaporation rate or sort of boil off rate or concentration rate or whatever, you know. But then the solar energy is boosted by putting 85% the waste heat from that process in its form of concentrated brine and fresh water, hot concentrated brine and hot fresh water. If you've got a retention and reuse rate of about 85% of the heat going in, that means you've got about, from a, say 100,000 watts of heat gathering area, you've now doubled that up to about 180,000 watts, and so you effectively, your water distillation process, you know, solar distillation, effectively doubles, more or less, you know. And, oh, it's, you know, it's up 80, say 85% or something, you know, 80, 85%. And so out of that 10,000 square metres, you're, I don't know, the factor I'm missing is the actual evaporation rate and, you know, but that then begets an extremely efficient process with no costs to run it, you know, with intelligent tidal pumping, you know, you can get all the fucking salt water pumped at a slow, you know, raised, you know, say 4 or 5 metres above, you know, a simple sort of ram type pump, you know what I mean, tidal pump. You can get about 100, what is it? You know, you can get a constant feed of fresh of seawater ready to feed in at a low flow rate to, you know, be turned into concentrated hot brine, you know, and it gets preheated as it comes in. It gets preheated by the hot fresh water and the hot brine concentrate coming out, you know what I mean? And so part of this process was that I designed a very simple steam conversion system, like a solar tower type thing, where the there was a tower up top that got very, very fucking hot, and water was pumped, salt water, doesn't have to be super high or anything, but salt water was pumped up into that. Then the steam went down the middle to preheat the incoming salt water, and then there's an auxiliary sort of input, because as the water got higher or lower, as the water got higher, it would concentrate the brine, and then the brine could be fed out, you know, sort of like an overflow pipe in a water tank sort of thing. But that would also be used to preheat the incoming salt water. And out of this process, as I got all the glassware to actually manufacture that, and so that explains why I've got some tube. And what's happened is this has gone on to sort of sit there. And also I've started to use it on other projects. Now, you know, this is some of it. Right. Glass tube. Right, but and it's useful, right? As a result of making things that fit between fountain pens, you know, there's your fountain pen, and then you put the pen up in there, and a syringe with ink. If you're refilling with the same colour, you can put your ink in here, say 5 mil of ink in there, and then you suck. I'm not going to suck the ink out of this, it's full, right? But you can suck up, say, 10 or 15, that's 10 mil, right? You know, you can suck 10 mil out of there, which causes a vacuum in the fucking reservoir, the empty tank, and then you push that back in, like so, and then that, you know, so you suck the air out, it sucks the ink back in, it sucks the ink back in. You can put a little bit of pressure on it, but these aren't really any sort of pressure sort of fittings. They blow off easy enough. and spray you with ink, right? But you can refill these fucking pens almost forever using this system, you know? So that's the process of using these fucking tubes and a syringe as a gas or ink pump. It's a piston pump, right? So to recap that. And as a result of that, normal eyedroppers tend to have little rubber bulbs on the end, and over time the rubber will perish from the oil in your skin, from being handled and all this sort of stuff. The rubber will physically rot. So therefore I found that I could use this to make my own eyedroppers, where I could actually draw up, you know, by the gauge on this, I could draw up, say, 1 or 2 mil of whatever solution, you know what I mean? And that was very, very handy, right? That's, you know, if I'm mixing inks or things like that, it's handy, right? And the other thing is, this is a very small piece. But by flame heart, this is called a pipette. I'll show you this. Where did I put it? Oh, God. Yeah, here we go. If I've got a big wound, or even a small wound, and I want to put some iodine on it, I can use cotton buds, which is just, you know, the whole cotton bud head thing. You know, the whole cotton bud head has to soak up, and then you got to put it all over things. But if I get this, right, I let the fluid run up inside and then I seal it with my finger over the end. Ta-da! You know, and that's very, very good. Right. And the thing is with this, is you need... You need a way, because glass tubing has, glass by itself just tends to be sharp edges, you know what I mean? And you don't want sharp edges on anything. So this is what is called, see, there's the residue in the tube, I can always clean it out. And also, by the way, iodine is one of the most corrosive fucking, the fumes of it in contact with anything. Don't have it anywhere near anything that is chrome plated, i.e. near your spanners or sockets, you know. Just keep it fucking sealed. You know. Oh, where is it called? Have it sealed in a Ziploc bag. Get off here, you fucking cunt. In a Ziploc bag and locked away in a plastic box inside the cupboards, because it's just corrosive, you know. And one of the things is there's really, really good glass blowing laboratories where they make scientific stuff and torches and torch heads, you know, I mean, for doing glass blowing work it's a real fucking science, so, you know. But what you can do is you can get one of these, right? Okay. These are like $10 or $15 for the torch. depending on who you are and where you are and how much you buy at a time, these little things are worth their weight in gold. They're handy. And here we have a glass tube, right? Now, I'll try and get this into fucking focus. This, you do this for two things. The first one is safety, because sharp edges are a fucking hazard. Right, so we will... That's called flame glazed, right? And this is see, that's got a sharp edge on it. So that's sort of there we go. See, so, and when this heats up, it can start to close up very, very quickly. You know, when it once it gets hot, I found a way to do this. Hurrah, hurrah. Look at that. See? Depending on who you are and how you are, and what you're using it for, you've got a very fucking small hole in there. Now, this is basically to draw up inks and to have a very fucking small hole. That should go. Very small hole. So it's not sort of falling out. It's just, it's got a very tiny hole to go. Not a very, very, very tiny hole, but a tiny hole. So that fluids will tend to stay inside the eyedropper, you know, rather than dripping over everything. So I'm going to show you how to flame glaze this. There's a nice smooth flame glazed edge, and there's a really shit edge, you know. Oh, I'll do you, show you how to fucking, trying to find things. Oh, man. I'm thinking of my science, one of my engineering teachers. We had a, like this is, we're paying our way to, at this sort of university thing. And we had a guy in the class who was just going, you know, just carrying on with shit like that every time the teacher's back was turned. And like, we're travelling fair distances to attend night school. And we're doing it because we want to be there. We want to earn the fucking, you know, qualifications. And we're doing it in our own fucking time. And this cunt wants to fucking wind the teacher up. So this went on for a couple of minutes, for a little while. And, you know, and I said, I fucking, you know, you're disrupt. I said, you know, because I could have fucking broken his neck. I said to this guy, I said, you know, your hassling the teacher is also bad for us. And we don't like what you're doing to him, and you, we don't like the fucking shit you're causing in this class. And I said, you know, forget the fucking school policies. I'm giving you an option. If you want to be here and learn, well, good. We'll do all we can to support you, you know. But if you continue to fuck around, I'll throw you out of the fucking class myself. you know. And, you know, the class, he finished that, he finished that, was the last class he ever turned up to. And I got a distinction. Hello. So, yeah. You know, because this teacher was fucking brilliant. He knew a lot. And he was very clever. And he was a good man, you know. And so I'm not having this absolute fucking asshole fuck around on my time in my class by getting on the teacher's case, you know. And I still miss him. I miss... with a sort of a great deal of gratitude, enormous amounts of gratitude for all my good teachers, you know. And I'm very sad that he got old and that he died, and you know, you can't stay in endless relationships with everybody, but you know, you can really capitalize upon the opportunities to learn. And when people say take advantage of, well, there's stuff that is, you know, it's an opportunity to learn, and they're good teachers and they will be of immense help. That is what it means to capitalise on the opportunity. So I'm going to show you how to use a little file and to... there we go. We file a little notch in it, you know, like that, right, you know. And that. Oh, where is it? There's a notch. There's a little notch in the glass. And so we go from the other side. Oh, where is it? That's at the top. That's the far side. Really, I should be wearing safety glasses, but this is not sort of... and this is how... This is a soda, sodium and lime glass. It's not a common glass. It's not boron silicate glass. So what you do is you softly heat that up, because if you heat it up too fast in one area, it'll crack, right? And then, see, what we want is we want for that glass edge, those glass edges to fucking weld or to liquefy on the edges and just, yeah. So, because that's one of those things, you know, you get those pedantic old cunts who insist on everything, right? So we've gone from a... see? That's called flame glazing, you know? I won't grab it yet because it's still hot. But you can feel glass tends to be not a very good heat conductor. But that there, the ends have been made safe, you know. And that's the other thing. Where is it? Now, this was accidentally sealed up because it got a bit too hot for a bit too long and the glass just surface tension, it sort of liquefies into itself, right? eBay. That's sort of sealed up, whereas see, you can see on this end it's not a little bit too hot, but you know, you can see how the hole is pulling over the outer edge, all the glass is sort of flowing together, and that's how you get it'll flow together to get a really small hole. Right. So these are the good things about glass. Now the current project, you know, I like to find out how things work. I like to figure stuff out, and then I like to make it work, and then after I've done it, I go, well, what else can I do? You know, just what I'm doing. See, in the 1780s and stuff like that, people were making barometers, mercury barometers, and they were doing all the sort of temperature compensation. Like, so this is scientific shit, you know what I mean? This is, I've got school books from the, I think, 1780, and, you know, kids were coming out of, like, grade six or whatever, and they were considered finished products, you know, educated products, so that they could operate commercially operate farms and businesses and all this sort of stuff. Granted that there's a lot of other learning to do too, but and I also think this is why the fucking Jews were just, you know, crushing, have been trying to destroy our, you know, education system by turning out stupid people, running stupid programs on TV, and getting into identity politics rather than just being formidable people with really, really, really good fucking added skills, right? But these people in, so people were coming out of grade six. They could read, write, do maths, all this sort of stuff, and those school books are fairly formidable, you know. They were equipped for life at grade six, you know, type stuff, you know. And from the French Scientific Society, they were making, I'll show you what this is. All right. So it's sealed at one end, right? It's exactly a metre long. The space inside it is a metre long. So if you fill this up with mercury, you know, there's a metre of it. There's one hand and there's the other hand. If you fill this up with mercury and seal it, you know, just with wax or something, and then, because you don't want mercury, it's very fucking dense. Drill this hole, drill this cap, put, say, half full of very dense mineral oil, you know, clean mineral oil, and then you put it into there like that, and then upend it, a certain amount of that mercury will run out and you'll have a space above the mercury column, and that, depending on the air pressure, that depending upon the air pressure will give you a reading of the atmospheric air pressure, which is indicative of A, altitude, the altitude that you're at, and B, changes in weather. So when the barometer, when the air pressure drops, that's usually, I forget which way it is, but when the air pressure drops, that means there's incoming storms, and when the air pressure rises, it means that there's, you know, so the mercury goes up and down and up and down inside the tube, you know, and this is a little reservoir down here. So this is why skills such as glass blowing and the other type of barometer I'm making is an oil-based one. Now, mercury's, I think it's either 22 or 19 grams a cubic centimetre, and the other oil is about 0.8 of a gram per cubic centimetre. So oil is also very temperature sensitive, and it's also, because it's so much less dense than mercury, the rate of rise and fall on this, if this was filled halfway with mercury and a small amount, a small amount in the reservoir with oil, you'd have to do a three-stage graph of air pressure and temperature and the amount of movement, because you're running two things that affect how much the oil expands, expansion rate and contraction rate at different temperatures, and it's what's it called? And the barometric pressure, how much it's going to rise just by it. If it stayed at, say, 20 degrees constantly, you'd be able to calibrate the fucking instruments, you know, simply on that basis alone. But this is going to be like, because the sensitivity is so much higher because the density of oil is so much lower, you know. But, you know, I think it was in 1780, I've seen if you look at the Royal Scientific Society or something in France, and in the Scientific Museum, and you get right into the history of these things, people were making mercury barometers and they were calibrating changes in, you know, if you went up, you know, if it depends on what it was for, you know, if you went, you know, from sea level to, say, 1,000-metre level, the air pressure's going to drop. So the barometric readings would be different for different rises and falls of air pressure based upon incoming current or outgoing weather conditions. And they were making altitude compensators. They were making temperature compensators, and this is like, I get overwhelmed because there's just so much clever, fucking really clever stuff, you know. And it's one of those things. Once I figure it all out, and if there's really any genuinely needed changes, then I do all of that sort of stuff, and once I've learned how to do it, I'll just sort of kind of lose interest, you know, unless it's something I can use, you know. But yeah, so I've got a tiny little bottle with about 3 mil of mercury, and that will suffice, maybe 4 mil, you know. but that will suffice for this project. And with a good layering, there'll be a pad in there to stop the fucking glass landing on glass and knocking the bottom out, you know what I mean? But there'll be like about three mil of fucking mercury in there, and about 10 mil of very, very dense clean mineral oil, you know, as a covering thing. And then the drilling around that will be fractionally oversized to allow venting. And yeah, so that's, you know, and that's the thing, you know, I've got junkies in the fucking neighbourhood who, they tend to take care of themselves, you know, but they spoil things because they're not prepared. They either can't or won't do what it takes to clean up their own, to sort their own shit out and to make themselves into better fucking people. So they go around trying to steal it from others rather than earning it. And, yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, so that's the thing. There you go. We'll be able to make my own genuine mercury barometer in a proper case and an oil-based barometer, a very high sensitivity, and you start to compare the notes and stuff like that, and people, you know, were making some incredible stuff. Go look up the French Royal Society or fucking Scientific Society and the Museum of Scientific Advancements and the exhibits, and then read up on what these things are and how they work. And it's just extraordinarily clever, you know. And I'm not saying I endorse some of these things, but, you know, if you had, say, a gun, a big gun, and you've worked out how to make it shoot, you know, it shoots big fucking big rounds, and they land, say, 20 or 30 k's away, or further nowadays, you know, right? The air, how much power to drive that fucking great big shell, you know, is dependent upon the propellant, right? How much propellant, and how that much, what that gun is aimed, the direction it's pointed, and how the elevation of the barrel, right? And these things are calculated based upon the air density at different, if at different altitudes and different wind directions, because if you look very carefully, you'll see that clouds are at a low altitude can be heading from west to east, and clouds at a high altitude can be going from north to south, you know what I mean? So there's, you know, and different air at different temperatures and different layers has different densities, right? And this is why the development of the self-guided ammunition has been such an important thing, because all the calculation tables of how far to lift that barrel and how, which way, you know, like, you know, up say 38.7 degrees and 11.5 degrees, by the time it gets to 30 k's away, well, if there's a crosswind, and the air, you know, it's going to be steering that fucking, drifting that thing off to one area, off target, and if the air density is too high, the thick if that's not calculated for, then the air has to go through thicker air for over a big distance, and it'll slow down, and so the fucking shell will land short of the target. And if the air density is very low, you know, the air's going to be thinner, so the fucking shell is going to overshoot the target. You know, so this is, I don't particularly endorse this, but this is life, you know. And this is why it's really important to learn, you know, about all these things, because it's like, you know, and I don't mean necessarily shooting other people up from 30 or 50 Ks away. What I'm saying is, it's like, you know, if you really want to do very, very good engineering, like, what's the fuel economy? What's the, no, fuck this economy word. What is the fuel consumption per kilometre, you know? So if you've got a flat road and it's a hot day, say 35 degrees, the air density will be different to air that is at 12 degrees. So that means that the air is either thinner or thicker that the car has to move through. So the thicker the air, the more the fuel consumption. You know, the more power is required at a nominal velocity. And if the air is very, very thin, you know, relative to the sort of range that the air tends to, you know, we're not talking about, you know, tropical monsoons with 500 k-an-hour winds, and we're not talking about, you know, ice ages and shit like that. We're just you know, like sort of, say, 70% of the fucking variation is between the maximum density and the minimum density, you know what I mean? It's sort of like in the fucking middle there, 90, 70% of the... I'm making this up because it's probably fucking accurate enough, you know? But 70% of your fucking air density readings, you know, barometric readings, are going to be between those two sorts of things. So, and the air pressure, depending on temperature and air pressure, that's going to be come back down to, you know, not only the thickness of the air, how hard it is to push aside and how much it drags moving down the side of the vehicle, but it, what's it called? It also varies the oxygen content of the atmosphere that the engine is actually using, you know. So, you know, this is why it's, you know, it's not just like, you know, they don't tell you these things, but it's important to know them. It's like, you know, it's like the offset. I worked out, people go, oh, drive in economy mode, drive slower, you know. So I'll make this up because it's just fucking easy, right? If I drive a car at 100 kilometres an hour, which is 100,000 metres an hour, right, or 61 metres a second, you know, what happens with that is if I slow down to 50 kilometres an hour, which is 50,000 metres in an hour, which is 31.5 metres a second, right, I will use, I think it's one quarter of the amount of fuel over a given distance, right? Because I will require one quarter of the amount of power at that velocity, you know. Because every time you double your speed, your power consumption goes up by four, punching this hole through the atmosphere, you know. And that's why, you know, low coefficients of friction type aerodynamic things, you know, the CD figures, that's why very, very low fucking things are so important on vehicles, because a really good, same vehicle, same occupant, same load, same engine, all this sort of stuff. One car, a really bad design, like not aerodynamic, it's made to get in and out and get, you know, to avoid getting shot at and to transport stuff and all this sort of stuff. Say like the Willys Jeep with the big fucking windscreen, you know what I mean? World War II, which I'm quite fond of. You know, that's not very aerodynamic, whereas a modern sort of car that is just all, everything's sort of enclosed and it's very sort of, you know, the air, the air flows up and over and round and there's only a small wake of drag behind it, you know what I mean? Their fuel consumption, one is like about four times the amount of the other, you know. This is the viscosity of the air, the density of the air, how much it weighs, how much you have to push aside, you know, all this sort of stuff. And, but that was the thing. If people do it 100 k's an hour, well, what they never tell you in all this economy mode, economy driving kind of shit, is that at 50 kilometres an hour, you're going to be driving, say, to get 100 k's instead of getting there in 1 hour doing 100 k's an hour. At 50 k's an hour, you're going to get there in 2 hours. So effectively, your engine is running for twice as long, right? And so the mystical sort of, it gets, you know, an economy speed. It uses, you know, say 5 litres per 100 kilometres doing 50 k's an hour. But at, 100 k's an hour, it's using, say, 15 or 18 litres to cover that 100 k trip, you know what I mean? So it's not... you got to get... Buy a fucking pen and start to calculate this stuff out for yourself. But anyway, that's the advantages of calibrating with air, you know, and there's wet and dry bulb thermometers. I've made up some of those, you know, so you can calculate the humidity, the temperature, the density, the air pressure. And you can start to calculate out from a number of basic sort of sources what's actually going on in the atmosphere. And it's very dynamic. So that affects, you know, just all sorts of things, you know. Humidity is the evaporation rate of rain and how quickly the soil dries out. That's temperature. There's an issue of temperature. There's also impending rainfall, you know, the higher the humidity, the lower the evaporation rate and the drying of the soil. You know, there's just tons of fucking stuff. It's really, really, really amazing. So, you know, I like to nut shit out so I know rather than all so-and-so reckons. Well, I heard, you know, you fuck off, you know, not interested. Anyway, gentlemen, that's today's lesson.